It's already recording, so. Hey, everybody. Welcome to our post-shine call. This is our, the epigenetics in action call, and it's just to really integrate the stuff you learned. How many people feel like they learned a lot at Shine and they right away, you're a master of all that information and can use it right away? Anybody? Yeah?
One.
Yeah? You got it? Okay, Terry, good. Well, you've been studying this a while. That's great. So new tools, new techniques and stuff to put into practice. But it takes some time. And so I'm going to do a little review. I also want to check around and check in with everybody at the beginning and just see if anybody wants to add a couple of ahas or things that you actually learned that you're going to either put into place right away for yourself or not. I know Marsha really integrated a lot because she and I had a conversation yesterday and she was telling me all the different genes that this explains this and this explains that and this explains the other thing. So that's really helpful when you look at your own genes is to say, oh, no wonder I X, Y, Z, right? No wonder I have these heart things. And what was the gene we wanted Diana to look up for herself? There was a specific gene Lynn and I were talking about as we made our as we were making those charts, and she kept coming to me and go, I bet so-and-so has this gene. I bet so-and-so has that gene. And one of them that came up, I can't remember which it was. It's so long ago and so much has happened, but we'll try to remember that and see if Diana can look that one up. It was one of the cardiovascular ones. So there's a lot there and we spent so much time and we have put so much love and attention into making those charts because I recognize and having been doing gene stuff for the last 12 years, how overwhelming it was at the beginning and looking at these reports and then you're looking at this and you're looking at that and you're trying to put it all together. So I wanted to be able to put it together so that you can, as a practitioner and also as a client, you can look at that chart and then you can turn it on its side, right? And see what the heck are all these things. And oh my God, we have 12 different things that said vitamin D. Somebody needs to be muted. I don't know who, but. Robin, maybe mute. Okay, a lot of people are mute. I'm just going to say mute all and then mute all. And that should keep me unmuted. Okay, good. I'll allow participants to unmute themselves, yes. All right. So I wanted to create something that we could easily use. We go, okay, this person presented with, this is the symptoms they presented with. I wonder if there's genes associated with it. The first thing I want you to know in putting this into action is it's going to be impossible unless you set up a gene call with somebody that's long and extensive to go through every single SNP that they have in a session. So don't feel like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? Feel like, okay, I'm going to integrate this with my typical history, with the way that I talk to them, with whatever other labs they're presenting with and go, wow, I wonder, wow, we got to look up Diana. I wonder if she has some cardiovascular SNPs. Oh, you've been having a hypertension problem. I wonder if they have the ACE or the NOS or some of the other cardiovascular SNPs and just look it up. I've really been enjoying that genetic detoxification report. I think it's just gone to the top of my list as my favorite just because of the way it's organized and the way it's organized can actually make sense to a client. Even if they don't know all the details behind it, it makes sense because they say, oh, I have problems in this area. It so finally breaks it down. And I like the metabolic healing one because it breaks it down. It has GI and brain, but it doesn't break it down as finely. And the descriptions, even though it has descriptions, it's really not meant for the lay person to read those descriptions because they're very technical usually, right? So I love these charts. And I so appreciate Lynn working with me on getting them done because it would have been about, three more days if I had had to do it all myself. So thank you. But two of us worked together day and night for 3 days to put these together. It was fun. It was exciting. And it was a lot of work. So I want you guys to get the most benefit from them. So I'm going to go over in a presentation. I put together a slide presentation, mostly just slides from Shine that I'm just pulled out to kind of summarize. So you don't need the slides, but you have all that stuff in Shine. But I really want to kind of summarize and remind you of some of the stuff. Some of it we went through very quickly, like the blood sugar and the digestion. I bet we could have spent a whole day on just digestion and blood sugar because there's so much there. And we just ran out of time to put those in the charts because there were so many. Like, okay, let's get the others done first because these are going to be like 4 or 5, 6 pages long. But somebody I was talking to today said, I love the way this is organized because before, you know, the descriptions are just like, oh, like, you know, 8 pages long if you have to lay all that out. And you're repeating things. There's a lot of things you're repeating, cruciferous vegetables, vitamin D. So why not have it on the chart with that, those little checklists so you can turn it and go, wow, you got so many indicators for vitamin D. We got to get your vitamin D status up. You've got so many indicators for needing cruciferous vegetables. What's it going to take to get you to eat these or get some broccoli sprout powder and kale powder and put them in your smoothies or something if you don't like the taste? So it, I find it really helpful. So I'd love to hear from anybody that really wants to share, like, what's one or two things that you feel like are, were the highlights for you in terms of putting this into practice, whether it be for your own health or for your clients? Anybody? Raise your hand. There's a way to raise your hand somehow. Raise your hand and let me know. We've got a lot of you on the call. So that's great. Anybody want to share? No aha moments that stand out? Nothing you're going to do? Like, what are you going to do with this information now that you're back over a week? Nothing? Somebody's noisy. Why does it do this when I... You are muted, yes. But it doesn't work. Zoom doesn't work all the time. I just did that twice and I said, you know. Anyway, okay, so if there's not, then I'm going to go through a presentation and then maybe the presentation will jar your memories and we can talk at the end. Sound good? Yes? Ready to go? All right. Good. So I am going to share my screen. I think it's that one. So, do you see my screen yet? Yes?
Yes. Yay! Yes.
All right. I'm going to do a backup recording just because every now and then, like, something happens with Skype, and so I'm going to do, okay, I got to move that out of the way, I got to say new. We had one time, and I'm burned by it, so let's see, this is... Since we got burned by once when thinking that Skype was recording and it wasn't, or it recorded somewhere and didn't save it, I like to do backups whenever I can. So once burned. Okay, so I'm going to just record this. It's a custom size of 640 by 480, 640 by 480 by 360. Where is it? See if that does it. No? Sorry about this. I usually don't do it in this size, so I just want to make sure I get the full size. Give me 1 second. Custom. I'm going to go... Just going to do it this way.
It looks like full size on my screen.
Here's there we go. Well, it's my recording thing. I have a separate screen to record it.
I see.
Yeah, it's full size, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. So that's the backup recording. Just wanted to make sure. All right. So welcome to our Epigenetics in Action integration session. And this is our follow-up from Shine to make sure that, you know, you have what you need and you can ask whatever questions were hanging and didn't get answered at the session. So what I want to do first is go through a little bit of a summary and just kind of a review of some of the stuff and just give you some ideas of how I would take this information and put it into action. So there we go. So the Shine Conference was the leading edge strategies to outsmart genetics. Do you feel like you got some leading edge strategies to outsmart genetics? Like this person has all these whatever SNPs and what can they do? We talked about how our mission is actually possible. And I am so dedicated to this mission of just changing the healthcare paradigm. And we can change it. And I see it happening all the time. I see it when I talk to people on about summits, and I see it in all the education that's happening on the web. But it gets confusing for people, and I want us to be the voice of reason. so that we can actually teach people how, in reality, to get to the root cause. And it's super important to do that because there's too many people being thrown drugs or herbs in, and herbs in the guise of being a holistic and get to the root cause. But it's like, oh, you have hot flashes. Here's some herbs. Oh, you have this. Oh, you ran this test. You're deficient in magnesium. Let's give you magnesium. But we have to be focused on the why question. We always want to go deeper and deeper and deeper asking why. Why are they deficient in magnesium? Is it an absorption problem? Is it a leaky gut problem? Is it they don't have enough in their diet? They're eating foods that are processed that are interfering with it. We always want to ask that deeper question, why? And then genetics plays into that. Do they have a genetic predisposition to low magnesium? And we did that in there. Why does it keep opening people's... Anyway, we know what happens when we don't get to the root cause, right? We've seen it. All of you have seen it, whether it's in your patients, your clients, your family members, yourself, where somebody just gave you this Band-Aid. And meanwhile, the house was still burning, but you didn't feel it. We see this a lot in people with peripheral neuropathy, right? Their feet are close to the fire. They're stepping on rocks and nails and they don't feel it. So everything's fine because I don't feel it, right? And it destroys them and some of them have to get amputated as a result. And the same thing can happen with throwing medications or herbs or something that's suppressing a symptom. That fire keeps burning and those folks are in trouble and we need to keep them out of trouble. So we're working on genetics, reminder of what SNPs are, those single nucleotide polymorphisms, one shift in that gene sequence, and it makes a huge difference. We know that, you know, that the SNPs make us different. 93% of us is the same as the rhesus monkey. 98.5 is the same as the chimpanzee. And 99.5, we're the same as each other. And look how different we look, right? Look at us on the screen. How can that be? We just want to It like took it slowly. All right. One thing I want you to remember is that the SNP, the change in that gene, can either make the processing go faster or slower. In most cases, it's faster, but in some cases, it's slower. And that's what Lynn and I were struggling with as we're looking at this one gene and we're looking at all the research and going, wait a minute, why does this place say that it increases the risk of cardiovascular disease? Why does this place say it decreases the risk? If we're reading this right, if the SNP actually decreases the activity of this gene, they should have a lower risk of cardiovascular disease. I don't remember the exact SNP we talked about, but that was what we said, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. And then we started digging and digging and digging and found, oh, it's a SNP that causes a reduction, a downregulation versus an upregulation. And Lynn, I'm going to ask you to monitor the mics and please shut
down. I'm working with Marcia because you made her the co-host and not me.
Oh,
everybody's mic is off. Everyone's mic is off.
Why am I hearing that reverberation? Weird. Okay, thank you. All right. We can have multiple co-hosts, by the way.
Yes, but you have to do it.
I have to do it. Okay, let me look at participants. And let me look at Lynn. So you're actually in as yourself now. Oh, that's the reason, because you logged out as me and logged in as yourself, because you were co-host earlier. Okay, sorry about that. Sorry about these interruptions, guys. All right. Lynn, make co-host. All right, got it. And you'd all. Yes. Okay. All right. So fast versus slow, the technical term would be upregulation or downregulation, right? And if you're reading something, you're going, wait a minute, why is that? Maybe it's a downregulation. And more information. We talked about methylation being that game of hot potato, pass the methyl group around, makes a huge difference. And this is the cycle. If any cycles, pictures that you can actually really commit to your memory, it's this one. This is the shorter version. That Ben Lynch one that has everything, there's no way you're ever going to memorize it. There's no way you're ever going to master that unless you have a photographic memory, which I don't, so I don't have it memorized. But I know where this fits in, and this I know pretty well. This one I know pretty well because I've looked at it a lot. And it just helps. Genetics being a piece of the pie, the lifestyle and diet are more. Review of how they're going to show up on the reports. I think you get this. The wild type, which is the normal, is green. The reds are homozygous, which means both mom and dad did you a number. And the yellow is heterozygous. You just have one gene and one wild type, one off gene. So the importance of personalized nutrition plan, and the, you know, I think that there's a lot of health coaches out there, and there's a lot of folks who just give people the same diet. There's a lot of teachers who teach, oh, just do this, because everybody with adrenal fatigue should get this, and everybody with digestive issues should get that. But that doesn't take into account the uniqueness. And the uniqueness is based on, yeah, the genetics, but also previous lifestyle exposures, previous traumas, emotional and physical, their stress level, and, you know, their belief system about who they are and what they do in the world. So we want to be able to create personalized nutrition and lifestyle plans, not go with the, you know, everybody gets the same thing. And we started with food and nutrient related genes. And this is the list. So here's the deal, right? Since we are looking at nutrition plans and they want that, this is a great place to start. You know, you start with somebody and you're listening to their symptoms and you're looking at what supplements they're taking and what they're eating. And you're going, huh, it sure sounds like they may have some nutrient imbalances. Maybe they have a magnesium, or maybe they have this, but wow, they're taking all this magnesium, or they're eating all these foods that are high in magnesium. I wonder if maybe their genes are getting in the way and we have to up the dose even more, or give them more, help their stomach acid and help them absorb. So we look at the chart and we find the ones for magnesium. I'd like on round two to have a chart that lists the nutrient somewhere and then the gene, but that will require a thing. So you look at this. I think this is only one page. There's one for magnesium. We have vitamin A, vitamin B6, zinc, iron, D, I think this was one of two pages, and maybe there was one on page two, or maybe we missed the magnesium. But anyway, that was probably a bad example. But we look and we go, okay, what genes do they have that predispose them? So we could help them focus on foods that are rich in those nutrients, and maybe as an interim, some supplements to get them through. So what do? You evaluate for the symptoms of nutrient deficiency. You don't just go, oh, you've got this gene. You have to have the combination of the gene and the history. Do they actually have symptoms of this? Do they actually show it on lab tests, right? Sometimes we want to do those lab tests, especially if there's a disconnect there. And if they don't have the gene predisposition, but they do have the symptoms and the lab tests show deficiency, then we need to look at what in their lifestyle is creating this, right? It's not the genes. You can't blame the genes at this point. So what other factors in their lifestyle are interfering with them making good decisions and having that? And then we educate them and supplement if needed. The brain chemistry, right? We had three separate sections on brain chemistry. We had the general brain SNPs, and we have the Alzheimer's, and we have the specific ones related to anxiety and sleep and all that. And we spent a lot of time on the brain SNPs, didn't we? We really spent a lot of time on that COM-T because there was some confusion about it, and we wanted it clear, but also because it was really one of the first SNP charts that we're looking at. We started with the nutrients, but those are straightforward, right? It's just like, oh, vitamin A, vitamin D, whatever. But with the others, right, with the brain chemistry, it's like looking at the various implications, how they interact with each other. And we spent a lot of time on that, but I think we got far. And now you guys know how to manage with these charts. And I think it's really important. You have somebody comes in and they have a long history of problems with anxiety, depression, memory, brain, you know, brain fog. You want to look at all three of these the pages to look at what is going on. Is there a genetic factor? Is it a situational thing? You know I've talked to people a lot about, wait a minute, you know, you're depressed or you're anxious or whatever the thing is it because there's some biochemical imbalance, or is it because life just handed you a blow and you're just going to feel down for a few days, right? Somebody dies that you love. You're going to feel down for a few days. That's not pathological depression. That's situational depression. But if that goes on for months and years, then there's some imbalance that's triggered. And it doesn't mean that you're deficient in Prozac or Zoloft or something like that. It means that there's an imbalance. And, you know, a lot of times when there is somebody has a loss like that, they slip into their emotional eating patterns. And what do they eat? Broccoli? Kale? Not on your life, right? They're eating M&Ms and ice cream, and they're just like filling the gap. And what does that do to brain chemistry, right? It throws off the gut. It throws off the adrenals. It throws off the brain. So we have to look at it like, wow, her husband died and she still has problems 2 years later, but she didn't have depression before that. It could be that that whole situational thing threw them into a spiral. So we always want to start with their lifestyle. We always want to look at what are the obstacles in the lifestyle. Is it in the home? Is it the cleaning products that they're using? Is it the cosmetics that they're using? And all of these factors play into the genes. So as you're starting to use this stuff in your own practice, I would say, you know, print them all out. If you don't have them printed already, print them all out and then keep them handy. Keep them in a, like, spiral bound them so you can flip through them when you're working with people. You might even laminate them so that you can do it. You might also want to print them out, at least the key ones, for that individual person. And as you're going through, you're circling the SNPs they have and just taking a marker and marking it, whether it's red, yellow. You don't have to bother with the greens. Just assume that if you don't mark it, it's green. And then fill that in on these. And then when you go back with this person, you're trying to get a comprehensive look at what's going on. You'll be able to see like major stuff going on. And then you'll have right there, here's some of the stuff, here's some of the patterns, and here's some of the lifestyle things and labs I might want to follow up with. Does this make sense? Is this helpful? Yes? Yeah. Cool.
Can I say something really quick?
Sure.
So one of the things looking at all of this is, and I know you really emphasize this, so this is just a snapshot of some of the things. There are other things that you can do, but like you said, I just wanted to emphasize, like you do, the foundational pieces.
Right.
And I know for myself, it was like, oh, but there's this. So just starting out with these foundational pieces is really a great place to start and to just feel confident that you are heading in the right direction. And as you start to implement it, you can actually create something similar to this where you add in your own items for your SNPs. So I just wanted to share that.
Sure. There may be other things. Maybe there's a therapy that you do that would really make sense for somebody with memory problems. You can add that. Maybe there's an energy modality that you do and you want to add it to this. There's just so much you can do, and you just write it in, right? Add it in, cross one out that you don't use very much, or put it back in the other one. But the point is that this is a piece, right? And when I said, called this outsmarting your genetics, what I mean is your genetics don't define, right? The genetics says, oh, I'm going to have hypertension. Well, I have some hypertension genes. I don't have hypertension. Why? Because of what I'm doing in my lifestyle. I was showing somebody my SNP charts this morning, and she says, oh my God, you're a mess. I'm like, no, I'm not a mess. I have the genes to be a mess, but this is a testament to I'm not a mess, right? Because I decided when I was 29 years old, based on the family history, based on what I was going through in my 20s, I must have bad genes. This was before the Genome Project. This was in the 80s. I must have really bad genes. So I'm just going to do all the things I just recently learned in getting over my current health crisis. I'm just going to do it 100%, 110%. I'm not going to do this, okay, now I did it, now I feel fine, now I can go back to eating M&Ms and drinking alcohol. I just won't do it as frequently. No, I said no. And when I look at this and I look at my family and their health and I look at, you know, their weight problems, and just found out recently that all but two of us are on anti-anxiety medications. And the one that isn't just recently did my sweet spot with me, and she is following along with some of the things that I'm teaching and has been for a few years, and the others aren't open to it. So this is what I would be if I didn't. You know, if somebody says to me, oh, you look so good. I can't believe you're in your 60s. You look like you're in your 20s by your body. Not my face, but your body. And they'll go, wow, you're so lucky. I'm like, luck has nothing to do with this. Luck is zero to do with this. Oh, you must have good genes. Genes will not, you know, why I look like I do or act like I do. I have all the energy I do. My brain chemistry, I'm way off. I should be like a basket case with brain fog based on my genes. And I was. I was when I was eating the standard American diet, when I wasn't meditating and taking care of myself. So these are the kind of, this is like the, I don't want to say the word ammunition because it sounds so negative, but it's the factors that you can use to influence people when they look at this. And they go, oh my goodness, I really do have to pay attention to my salt intake because I have that ACE gene. Oh, I really do have to eat more cruciferous vegetables even though I don't like them because I have all these SNPs. I don't want breast cancer, or I already had breast cancer and I don't want a recurrence. So what do I have to do? And looking at it, I've looked at it with people and gone, no wonder you had breast cancer. You had the combination of the genes and then you added to that the standard American diet, lots of stress. And of course, but now it's different, right? Now you have the power, the influence, the knowledge to change that. And for yourselves, if you looked at this for yourself, but also when you're working with people, this is how you can empower them to take the steps. And a lot of the steps you're going to empower them to take based on this, look at those lists, like reduce alcohol, caffeine, you know, increase cruciferous, increase green leafies. It's stuff you probably would have said to them anyway. But you're giving them a specific reason why this particular thing, why this avoidance of nitrate containing foods is going to be important for them because of their current genes. They're going to be more prone to have negative effects to things that everybody will have negative effects to, but not as damaging or debilitating. Is that making sense? Right. So you use this on yourself. I know who got inspired by looking at this to go, I better change a few things. Right? Yeah. Right? I better change a few things. And for me, looking at the sleep ones, it's like I'm really inspired to put the emphasis on my sleep. I used to think I could get away with not sleeping because I eat well and I exercise and I meditate and I do all this great stuff. And then when I found that I had the pre-insulin resistance situation, I was like, oh, well, I can't just choose a few of them and, you know, neglect the others. And I think we all need to just get into that mode. And people say, well, that's hard. And I go to these events. I go to the events too. I'm there all the time. I'm traveling all the time. But you make concessions. I loved it when Marcia stepped up and it didn't even occur to me. This is my 11th live event for 3 days. It didn't occur to me to ask the hotel to provide clean rooms. To provide, you know, not use chemicals in cleaning our rooms. It never occurred to me. And Marcia said that. I'm like, oh my God. Well, of course, we have people coming to our event. We want them to have access to a clean room and not have to breathe these chemicals, especially if you have some of these SNPs, which I do. Some people are the canary in the coal mines. You know those people, right? They go, I'll be sitting at lunch. They go, this salad mustn't be organic. What? What do you mean? Oh, I can feel it already. I can feel those pesticides. I'm like, really? Wow. It doesn't bother me quickly like that, but it builds, right? So I love those people because those people are the ones that let us know, right? The ones that can't deal with the gas fumes, sure, they have broken SNPs and that's why they're more sensitive. But the rest of us who may not realize it, we're still having the damage from that stuff. Because the cells are still getting exposed and maybe our detox pathways are pretty good at getting rid of it, but it's still putting a load on the liver. And what I like to look at is when we put a load on the liver because we're having caffeine, for example, that's taking those liver pathways away from detoxifying 4-hydroxyestrogen, which is damaging and can cause breast cancer. Like, do you want to have coffee at the expense of not having your body detoxify and causing an increased risk of breast cancer? And when you can play with this, and when you can play with your languaging, you don't want to hit people over the head and say, you're bad, boom, bad. No, you want to talk to them about, well, you have a choice. I can't tell you not to drink coffee anymore, but when you drink that coffee, it's taking away your body's ability to handle this estrogen, which gets produced all the time. It's a metabolic waste, and not be able to get rid of it. So you're increased risk of breast cancer. And then if you can do like a Dutch test, and that's why we put the labs in there, We put the labs in there so you know if you're going to follow up and people need proof. Sometimes people need proof, right? You know what labs to do. You know if they have some of those SNPs that predispose to breast cancer, you really want to do, you definitely want to do a Dutch test or something like that, the 24-hour Meridian Valley, because it gives you a snapshot of all their estrogen metabolites. Is this helping? Does this make sense?
Yeah, actually, I have a question from somebody. They asked if you could address the heterozygous SNPs and what focus goes on those relative to the homozygous SNPs.
Great question. Great question. So in general, this is just a ballpark figure. It might be a little different from SNP to SNP, but I think about the homozygous as causing a disruption of 60 to 80% of the function of that enzyme, enzyme, right? The gene coding for that enzyme. And if there's like five genes that are coding for a particular thing and you have one of them and they're homozygous, I don't know how to make the math work for that because I don't think anybody's ever really studied it as well as we could. Like, cause some of them are more and some of them are backup. So like, for example, what has been studied is MTHFR C677T, very critical one. And 40% of the population has that as a homozygous or heterozygous. And then a smaller percentage has it as homozygous. When it's homozygous, you've got a like 75% reduction in the enzyme function. So it's only functioning at 25%. Think of how you feel when your brain's only functioning at 25%. Not so hot, right? Everything is kind of like in slow motion and sluggish. But this is what happens with that enzyme. With a hetero, you've got maybe 30% decrease in that enzyme function. So you're functioning at 70%. You feel much better when you feel like you're functioning at 70% than 30. With the MTHFR, though, they found that if you combine, if you have two heterozygouses with the main ones, the others don't seem to be as clinically relevant. They're more like, I guess, a backup thing. Then it may be more. It may be 50% if you have double heterozygous versus 80% if you have homozygous. Does that make sense? Only 3% of the population has double homozygous in MTHFR. I've never seen it. Okay. I've also very rarely seen somebody without an MTHFR SNP at all. Very rarely. Maybe, you know, I think I've maybe seen 3 or 4 or 5, somewhere in that very low number with the hundreds that I've looked at. So it's rare for somebody who's symptomatic, because I don't see people who go, I feel great. Can you test my genes? It would be nice. It would be a good thing for people to do. And it would be a great thing for people to do when we have a kid, right? When the kid is born, let's test their genes so we know how to raise that kid. You know what I mean? And how, oh yeah, I let them have Coke when they go to the parties, and I let them eat this when they go to the parties, and I let them eat hot dogs. But then if you look at their SNPs, you go, oh, no wonder this kid is acting out. No wonder this kid has asthma or diabetes happening at an extraordinary early age. You know, I did this on my, it didn't happen when my kids were born. They didn't have all these reports, but I did it on my younger son. He's probably 12. And I looked at him and went, oh, no wonder this kid had difficulty falling asleep at night. No wonder this kid was so sensitive the one time he ever ate a hot dog when he was 4, and he came back and I thought, oh my God, he's going to be throwing up, I hope, because he's going to be feeling uncomfortable and miserable. And he wasn't. But that night he was like standing on top of the sink when he was told to go in to brush his teeth. He was like standing on top of the sink and I'm looking and going, come on down. Oh, come on down. I kept having to do things to Craig. He goes, Mommy, I don't know what's wrong, but I can't follow the rules tonight. He was off the wall hyperactive, crazy hyperactive. So up until then, I'd fed him such a clean diet that he didn't have access. He had a white flour bun. He had hardly any gluten. And if he did, it was sprouted wheat berries. And he had the hot dog and whatever ketchup or sauce when he went to somebody's house. And he just kind of looked sheepish. And then we passed the hot dog stand 2 days later. He goes, I'm not doing that again. So, it was obvious in his genes why that happened, right? Had I had that or somebody else, like I was dedicated and I raised them well, but somebody who was like, oh, it's okay. I give them a little good food, but occasionally they have hot dogs and whatever. If you have their genes when they're little and you see that they have all these broken detoxification pathways potentially, or the potential for those pathways to be broken. You want to feed them in a way that they're not going to express this stuff, that they're going to have a long, healthy life. You look at the diabetes genes, like I wish there's so many people who have type 1 diabetes that had they been raised from birth on a clean diet, avoiding the cow's milk dairy, which has been shown over and over again to create antibodies to the pancreas, had they been done that and had they not been, you know, vaccinated and not had dental fillings at the age of 4, wow, this person would be a healthy individual. But because of the SNPs and the lifestyle combination that type 1 diabetes expressed, just like there's genes on the autoimmune page for Hashimoto's and Sjogren's and all kinds of diseases, they won't express and they can be reversed if we get rid of the stressors. Those of you in NEPT, we have so much information on handling autoimmune diseases in the immune system module. We have it in the thyroid module. We have it all over the place. It's like, you'll get how to do that. And it's like, no, you can't. I was just interviewed on a summit that's going to be coming out in February called Mastering Diabetes. And they were asking me lots of questions. And they said, what do you think, can type 1 diabetes truly be reversed? Have you seen there's an indicator of pancreatic function called C-peptide? We talk about that in the advanced lab module. And there's a thing, he goes, have you ever seen the C-peptide go down? I said, honestly, I haven't worked with that many type 1s. The one I did work with most recently was LADA, which is latent adult onset diabetes, and it's autoimmune. And his hemoglobin A1C came down, his fasting glucose came down, he was able to get off medication, but never came back. He was feeling so good after 6 weeks. He gave the other 6 weeks of his sessions. Yes, I feel so good now. I know what to do. Can I just give my last 6 weeks to my wife because she has this other issue? So I never really followed up with him to see if he went back and did those tests over the years. So I don't know that answer. So basically my answer was, I don't know for sure, but my belief is it depends on how far along they are. And at least we're going to keep them from getting worse. And if we catch it early on, if we know they're genetically prone, or there's the first indication like they're peeing more than they should, they're thirsty more than they should, you know, some of the things that indicate the type 1, that I think we can honestly keep it from expressing. Once somebody's 20, 30, whatever, that it gets diagnosed, there may be too much stuff that's been damaged in the pancreas, but we can at least keep it from getting worse, because the traditional is it gets worse and worse. They need more and more insulin. They get all the damage and the peripheral neuropathies and the retinopathies, and then they get all the damage from the excess insulin, and it's problematic. So all of these things I'm saying because I want you to see that this is a picture that helps you to influence your clients and influence yourself to actually make some of the changes you already knew that they should make or that you should make. But it's like, oh my gosh, I am a time bomb waiting to happen and I'm not going to do it. Now, in spite of the genes that I have, and you also had access to my sample reports, I think I'm functioning really well. When I looked at them, I'm like, oh, I'm worse than some of my worst chronic fatigue patients, right? Why? Because it was 30 years of amazing, good nutrition. Not perfect. Nobody's perfect, right? Sometimes too much raw cacao sweetened with Lohan late at night. Still not a good thing to do, right? We still all work on our stuff, right? So then we had the mental health genes. Action plan. I want to review the action plans with you because I want you to know that we just keep coming back. Like Lynn said earlier, the foundational diet and lifestyle habits. We can't do, like, one of the reports I got was from Amy Yasko years ago. And I put my genes in and she came out with, here's your supplement plan. It was 17 pages long. Probably would have cost me $1,000 a month. And I'm perfectly healthy. Like, wait a minute. She's just taking the genes and helping us to say, you know, what should we do? No, you've got to address the diet and lifestyle. It's ultimate. And our seven pillars, our body freedom pillars, so, so important. We also have to make sure we optimize their stomach acid because they need protein and minerals. The stomach acid will help with digesting protein and minerals. Not enough of it, you can't solve these problems. avoiding allergens and the brain stimulants. So many people are on MSG and aspartame. They think, oh, I'm diabetic. I'm going to eat this artificially sweetened stuff, and it's affecting their brain chemistry. So we want to avoid that. We want to get them managing their stress, because no matter how good you are taking care of yourself food-wise, if you're stressed out all the time, if you're in that sympathetic, I get in sympathetic when I'm teaching because I'm excited. It's a different kind of sympathetic than anger, etc., but it's still sympathetic, and you need a break from that, right? So every now and then you're going to notice that I breathe, I pause, and my voice slows down. But my tendency, look at my genes, my tendency is chubby, right? Out there, right? That's my tendency, and I have to catch myself and slow down, because not everybody can keep up with my pace. And then the supplements as needed, the major ones, the B vitamins, the amino acids, the omega-3s, but also be super careful. We talked a lot about the interaction between MTHFRs and MTRRs, which are B12 and folate related. And we want to go, oh, let's just give them lots and lots of methylated B vitamins. And then you find that they're wanting to kill people or kill themselves because they're so anxious. We've got to be careful with that. So we look at the COMTs. And if it is the worrier gene, the double red, right? If we look at that, we go, oh, well, they don't always handle methyl groups well. So we have to go slowly. Yes, they need a methyl groups if they have some methylation defects, but we have to go slowly. We have to just give them drop doses. And my favorite way to supplement the B12 and folate is to get liposomal drops. And you can get that through Seeking Help. I use Seeking Help a lot. They have very pure supplements. You get them through Seeking Help and you have them take one drop. The bottle will say 40 drops is the dose. That's 5,000 milligrams, 5 grams. I'm not giving anybody 5 grams. I don't care what their SNPs are. And I err on the side of caution when I'm supplementing low and slow, low and slow, unless I really know that they can handle it. Does that make sense? Because if you give them too much, if I give them 40 drops and they have a double COMT, and especially if I don't know, because a lot of them come in to me, they have had a doctor that just tested MTHFR. And put them on all this high dose folate and B12. And they're like, I'm so anxious. I'm so this, I'm so that. And we just like take them off. And they feel better within a couple of days. And then we give them slow doses. And I always ask people, do you have a tendency to be anxious, right? Do you have a tendency to get worry a lot? Because if I don't have the genes, I can ask questions about the symptoms, which is why on these charts,
When you get to a break, can you, there's a couple of questions and it's a review because I believe you touched on it at that conference, but the difference between down-regulating and up-regulating and how can you tell if the SNPs are doing that? And then also just, again, a review of what methylated mean.
Okay. All right, so I'll start with the methylated because that's an easier one. It's a group, CH3. And I have the picture with the hot potato. Let's go back to it so you get a visual of it. Somebody said, oh, my God, that hot potato picture, right? You know, they've got it, and you don't want to keep it because you're playing a game, and you got to get rid of the hot potato. This is what the methyl group is. So we transfer that methyl group from folate, and then folate transfers it to B12, and then B12 transfers it to methionine, and the methionine transfers it to SAMe, and then SAMe goes and does the thing. So it gets around. And there's others. There's the BHMT pathway through the middle. So we have betaine and DMG and other chemicals. But it's basically we're moving it around until it gets to destination. At destination, it has so many functions, right? It helps to detox certain things in the liver, like heavy metals. It helps to repair DNA, which is, I guess, one of the most important things, right? Because you have DNA that's not working properly, you're going to have a lot of problems. So it helps to repair the broken DNA, and it helps to create the DNA. And so that gets moved, the methyl group gets moved around. Why does the body do it that way? There must be some good underlying reason. Why don't you just take it and pass it right to where it needs? Because it needs to go through the cycle. There's a cycle, and it's that cycle is used to move homocysteine around and decrease the homocysteine, which can be toxic to the brain and the blood cells. So that's what methylation is. Does that make sense what the methyl group is? It's just a simple CH3, carbon and three hydrogens. And you people, they're passing it around. The other question about up and down regulation. So let's say we have, let me think of a SNP. We have a SNP that decreases spasming in the blood vessels, right? And so in that particular case, we want that SNP to be activating because we want to decrease spasm in the blood vessels, right? Now, if you have a SNP there, the SNP, if it's upregulated, will increase how well that works. So sometimes the SNPs are actually beneficial. And it, you know, it decreases spasming. And wow, now we have even a greater decrease in spasming. That could be problematic because if we don't spasm or constrict the blood vessels at times when we're exercising or when we need it, then that could be problematic, but it's going to provide different symptoms than if that SNP is downregulated, meaning it's working less, because what that means is that we're going to have very spasmed blood vessels, which could increase the risk of stroke and heart attack. Now, how do we know? How we know is, number one, we look at the research. Like some of them are known to usually do downregulation or an upregulation. Most of them do downregulations. They make it less efficient. There are a few like CBS that sometimes does both, one of each kind. It sometimes is increased and sometimes it decreases. So I think most of it is to really pay attention and to look. So CBS, for example. CBS comes right below homocysteine in our chart. Let me go to our chart there. So CBS is over here down below. So we have this cycle where we go from folic acid to all these different pieces and just different spots. And the main thing is we go from MTHFR to the folate comes in. The MTHFR comes in and methylates the folate and adds the methyl group. And then we pass it on, and then we go to the B12, and we have this whole thing. Homocysteine's here, and we want to decrease it. So the homocysteine comes up and latches and grabs the group and then goes up to methionine. The CBS comes down here. Now, if you look at this person, and they either show signs and symptoms of low glutathione, or they're super sensitive to sulfur, this could be an upregulation. They're producing too much sulfur. They don't get enough glutathione happening, or they get the normal amount, but then it backs up and they create sulfur and sulfate. So you have to kind of look at symptoms. We also look at labs. There are labs you can do if you're not sure what's happening with this person, and they have persistent symptoms in spite of the fact that you're doing everything right according to the good basics and then what their SNPs are showing. So it's not real easy to know. And you saw when we were doing the research that it was confusing because some people were saying that this did one thing and some said the opposite because it's variable. And we don't know in the person unless we look at what's happening and what their symptoms and the diseases and all that are. Does that help? Okay. Any other questions before I move on? No? Is everybody good? Is everybody following? Nod your head if you're following. If this is helpful. I mean, I know, you know, it's a lot of review, but it was a big conference and there was a lot of information. And I think some of it might have just gone over your heads. It would for me too. Okay. So we have cardiovascular diseases. Again, the genes related to cardiovascular is somebody like my parents, right? My parents had heart attacks very, very young. But here's the thing that I discovered in looking more carefully at my genes. I don't have a lot of cardiovascular SNPs. What I have is blood sugar SNPs. So my parents died very young, which means that I think that there was a very strong gene component and there was a very strong lifestyle component, you know, the smoking and the bad food and all that. It wasn't a lack of exercise for my mom because she swam every day and she walked and she gardened, but she ate crappy food and she smoked cigarettes. But George Burns lived to be 105, whatever, 100 years old doing that same stuff, probably worse than she did. So what was it that caused her to go? Well, we have a lot of blood sugar imbalance SNPs, a lot of them. I had to get it from both of them, right? And so when the blood sugar is out of balance, they were in the they were probably insulin resistance, but the doctors back then didn't know that, you know, anything over 90 was a problem. So I don't have their labs. I wish I did. But the point is that I think what happened was they had the blood sugar imbalance SNPs. Their diet pushed them over the edge, and that created the damage. High levels of insulin damage the endothelial linings, right? High levels of glucose damage the nerves and the blood vessels. So I think that that was the issue. So that's how you can look at these things. You go, wow, this person has a family history of heart disease, but they don't have a lot of these. We don't have an ApoE. I don't have a 4. I just am a 2-3. Like, why? So that really got to me. It's like, okay, what I really need to do is protect my blood sugar, not the fat system. I don't seem to have a problem with fat, as long as it's good fat, right? Whole food, plant-based fats that are not hydrogenated and heated and processed. So this will help you to see, like, oh, I expected. Like, Marcia, if you looked and said, wow, I don't have any SNPs for blood pressure, why do I have this blood pressure issue? That would create more of a mystery and a digging. You're like, well, I don't know why. Let's look. But when you look at it, you go, okay, I have these SNPs. Therefore, it predisposes me to being more sensitive, and I have to be really careful about what I do to do that. And it I believe it's a relief. Maybe some people think it's not, but I think it's a relief to know, oh, no wonder, blah, 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 I've got that SNP. No wonder I've always been felt overwhelmed and had to calm myself down for years until I learned HeartMath, the meditation and all. I have all these genes for it. It's in my genes, but it's not an excuse. It's not like, oh, well, I have the genes, I'm just going to get this thing and die. No, I'm going to do something about it. Does that make sense? So with these, like if somebody has this issue, this is the blood pressure, right? So if you've got the ACE, ignore the bottom part. We have to go back and edit that. Let's make a note, Lynn, to do that and just edit it and re-upload that thing. The ACE and the ADD1 and the AGT, these are all problems that create blood pressure. And then the other one is the NOS, nitric oxide. So what can you do? And you've got it right here. And this is a way to learn how to deal and manage these particular situations and conditions. And of course, it's totally up to the individual. It's not just something that, you know, everybody has to do all of these things. That makes sense? And then there's the cholesterol. Like, I didn't have any of these SNPs. And the blood clotting. You know, if somebody has problems with their blood clotting, they can be prone to a heart attack and stroke. They can be prone to high blood pressure because the clots get in the way. So these are all things that you can do. And I just recommend you print them and then you say, okay, how is this person presenting? What are my main symptoms? And just try to look at that for a start. You'll get overwhelmed if you try to look at all of them and create a plan that carries everything. You go, okay, what is this person prone to? Ah, no wonder you had breast cancer. No wonder you had hemochromatosis or whatever. You have some SNPs that predispose you to it. And the action plan, like most of them are the same at the top, right? Foundational diet and lifestyle. But advanced lipid panel, if anybody has a family history or the genes predisposing to cardiovascular, make sure you get that advanced lipid panel. And I think Dr. Hopkins did an amazing job of explaining that and why it's so important and how you can have hidden signs of it and why you want to be really careful with it. And avoid oxidized fats, saturated fats. Those are going to damage the endothelial lining. Regular exercise, cardiovascular, stress management, heart math, meditation, yoga, tapping, whatever your favorite brand is. And then the supplementation might be needed, especially if you look at the lab and you look at the genes and you look at the family history. It's like, honey, you need to take this stuff because maybe you can get away with doing it with food, but I don't want to take that chance, right? High omega-3s, magnesium, CoQ10, niacin, hawthorn berry, really, really good. Hawthorn berry is so fun and easy to take. You just, you know, get the berries and you soak them and you make a tea or you soak them and soften them and throw them in smoothies. And, you know, there's so many ways to do it. And it's just so cardioprotective. It's a food. And just that's a great place to start. It's easy, right? On the omega-3s, at least get them started on some good omega-3s, like at least food-wise, if they don't want to do supplements and you're trying to convince them, you just get them started on at least getting some flax and some chia and some algae, if they're vegetarian. If they're not, and you can get them to eat a little bit of fish, but you got to be careful, right? You got to look at the mercury and you got to look at the pathways in the liver to see if they can even detoxify it. Right? So I'm a real fan of just keeping the toxicity low. When in doubt, leave it out is my motto. And, you know, before you address these, again, going back to foundational diet, remove all the folic acid, because even if they don't have MTHFR SNP, that folic acid interferes with the methylated folate attachment, especially at the blood-brain barrier. And this is an important nutrient to get into the brain. So I really recommend that. And of course, design a gut healing and pathogen removing program. Address the mitochondria, address the blood sugar, test homocysteine. Because especially if they have an MTHFR SNP, you want to test that homocysteine to see if it's expressing. And if the homocysteine is in a nice level, great. If it's not, let's just really get up on those B vitamins to help bring it down. The beauty of homocysteine is that even conventional Western docs are actually starting to test it. Is that cool? That's one of the few things they know nutritionally. Of course, they know just, here you go, here's some B6, B12, and folate. But the thing about it is that will bring it down so quickly. So while we're trying to get at the root cause, while we're trying to get at why these things are out of balance, why don't we just step in and do the Band-Aid, right, while we're figuring it out? It's important because we want to get the risk low, right? We don't want people to be working with us and it's going to take 3 years to replenish and they're dead before that because they had a serious situation. You have high homocysteine, and I think high homocysteine is over 8. The labs say, you know, 10 or 12, but I don't want to take that risk. I don't want it to be over 8, you know, ideally between 6 and 8. The adrenal support and the adaptogens, because most people are stressed out and the adrenals affect everything. It affects the thyroid. So if they have thyroid SNPs, you better be addressing their adrenals. If they have any of the estrogen metabolism SNPs, let's address their adrenals, because the adrenal hormones are precursors to the specific SNPs that are the specific chemicals, the steroids. So it's all the steroid pathways. Inflammation, we shot you this. You got somebody with rheumatoid arthritis. You got somebody with high C-reactive protein in their blood. You want to look at, do they have any of these SNPs? And you want to really, really regulate it. Fatty acids are a great regulation. Your omega-3s, turmeric, ginger, boswellia, cat's claw. There's so many herbs that you can use to help them. And we have some of those listed there.
And can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Somebody posted. So let's say you have a client that has high blood sugar, but they don't have that SNP that says you're predisposed to having insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes or anything like that. So outside of addressing the foundations, the way you work with them, you don't, it's how do you work with them? If I understand this person's question on the chat.
How do I work with them? I don't care whether they have the SNP or not. If they have elevated blood sugar, if they have elevated insulin, if they have elevated hemoglobin A1C, I don't care whether it's genetic or not. I know that if it's genetic, they're going to have a little bit more problem. It's going to take them more work. But those people who come to Sweet Spot and they just like soar through it, they do it. And then afterwards they're eating, you know, bananas and pineapple again, and it doesn't cause them a problem. That's because they don't have the SNP. Those of us who do have the SNPs, we're just being careful for the rest of their life and constantly doing a little testing. But nobody should go back on the junk. So everybody needs to be off of the processed foods, the processed sugars, the processed grains. And during an insulin resistance reset, possibly whole grains even, and legumes, just because you have to see what it raises. So I would take them through the exact protocol that we do in Sweet Spot. It's just, I would feel like, oh, this person's going to have a much easier time of it. Right? They're going to make it through much better, where this person who does have those blood sugar SNPs, it's going to be a little more difficult. Right? They're going to have to work harder. It's going to take longer. But yeah, I would address it the same way, whether they have the SNP or not. It's just the prognosis, if you want to use the medical term, is better for the person to have quick recovery if they don't have the SNP, but totally can have the recovery. Now, I have a lot of those SNPs, and I'm still careful. Now, there's a lot of foods I haven't even tried to see, but every now and then when I try, I usually overdo it. So I try a big plate of fruit instead of a little bit, and I still have problems. But if I'm sleeping well and I'm not stressed, and I can get away with more. So it's really balancing all of that stuff. But I don't want to die like my parents did. I don't want my heart to kick out. I don't care if I ever eat M&Ms again. I will never eat M&Ms again. I will never eat ice cream again. I will never eat crappy food again, ever in my life. And I can say that with 100% certainty. Do you know why? Because I haven't eaten any of those things in 33 to 35 years. So I ain't going to do it. There's nothing that could make me do it. To me, they look like dog poop. I wouldn't eat dog poop, right? So I'm not going to eat that stuff because I know it damages me, right? And it's just the way I am. And it's just part of that might be the GADs and the MAOs and the persistence and that hypervigilance. But I'm not doing it. But it's not a matter of willpower. Somebody said to me, well, it's your birthday. Have some birthday cake. No, I would rather eat something that I really enjoy that nourishes my body. I loved Karen Osborne's fudge that night at the event. Oh, my God. That was great. It was totally low glycemic. It was loaded with stuff. When I make fudge, if you come to our vital call on Saturday, we'll send an email out to everybody. But we're going to do, it's in the kitchen and it's for the holidays. And I only got through half of it last time, so I decided to finish it this time. And it was basically, I've got all these recipes that I used to bake a lot. I used to make all this Christmas stuff. And it was like, okay, now what am I going to do? So I've been creative over the years to create these things. Well, we have a brownie recipe, which I'm going to also see if I can make them into Christmas cookies with the thing. Usually I put them in a pan and I, you know, freeze them or dehydrate them depending on the recipe. And I squares, you know, it's brownies or a little walnut on top or whatever. I just had this thought as I laid in bed this morning when I first got up, I might be able to, let me try that. I'm going to try to make them with my Christmas cookie cutouts. And make some Christmas cookies out of the brownie recipe. But getting back to the brownie recipe, my brownie recipe, the secret ingredient. Anybody want to know my secret ingredient in my brownie recipe? Some people know. Kale. Kale. And when I bring this to parties, people are like, these are the best brownies. Like, these are healthy. I bring them to like a healthy pot. Like, these are healthy for me. Yeah, there's no sugar. It's just sweetened with a little bit of stevia and lohan or whatever. And I'll go, wow, these are so good. Well, how do you make them? And when I tell them, they're like, kale in brownies? Where'd you ever come up with that idea? But oh my God, they taste so good. I used to make my kids when they were younger, I'd make them these oatmeal cookies. And I would put kale and chopped up kale and broccoli in there. And I would make them for parties. And the parents would come and go, wow, my kids like love your cookies. And I know you're really healthy. What's in those cookies? Can you give me the recipe? And when they saw it, they were shocked because there was ground up broccoli in my cookies. So it's ways to teach your clients and yourself how to incorporate, like make everything a health food. So yeah, I can make Christmas recipes that are, you know, obviously a lot better, but how can I fortify them? How can I sneak kale and cordyceps and other kinds of really medicinal things into them? And it's just a fun thing. Marcia sent me a recipe last night that somebody had requested to do on Saturday. And she sent me the vegan, she sent me the, you know, regular version. She sent me the gluten-free version. And I went, oh, okay. And I just sat down and I went, what would I replace this with? We'll try it. Like, it doesn't hurt to try. I'm going to try it in front of hundreds of people. And if it doesn't work, I'll say, oh, well, it didn't work. Here's what I have to add. But I have it on paper. That's how I visualize recipes. What do I want this person to have? What do I want this person to avoid? And how can I take their favorite recipes and create something that works? You know, sometimes my amounts are not exactly right on paper and I'll have to adjust it. Like I replaced, what was it? She had jelly. Oh, she had like a honey. So that's a thick, gooey kind of thing. What can I do that's thick and gooey? I thought Irish moss paste gel, right? I'm not sure the exact amount, but I just replaced it one-to-one. And then you add to that, because it's a sweet, gooey stuff, I add to that some stevia or lohan or something like that. And I make my own version of honey, right? So we think about these things. We look at what the people can digest, what they can't digest, what they can eat, what they can't eat. And how do you come up with recipes for them that are totally like over the top good that they're going to love to eat. And that's what happened with a lot of the foods at Schleimbier. Like the people, when we first were there and they made their, the mousse or whatever, the lime, key lime mousse, I think we had one day. And they were like, I can't believe we're putting avocados and zucchini in our dessert. Like they were blown away. And then after they did it, they're like, this is really good. We should put this on our menu. So we want to work with people and make them love the food and not feel like they're deprived. I don't feel like I'm deprived. There's a lot of foods on my don't eat list, but I don't feel deprived. I feel invigorated. Celiac, right? If they have the celiac genes, full blown versus a tendency to celiac. If they have any of the genes on this page, get them off of gluten. Don't play Russian roulette with them. Get them off of gluten. Got to do it. And then there's other things to help heal the leaky gut. It's an autoimmune. And in all autoimmune diseases, there's a very similar pattern. It's going to vary from, you know, where the organs are affected. But autoimmune, you got to heal the leaky gut. You got to get that inflammation down. Get off of the trigger foods. You've got to get the stomach acid working. Got to get rid of like the metals if they have heavy metals in their mouth. Got to get their iron levels all, you know, leveled out so that they have good oxygenation to their tissues. You've got to get rid of all the stressors, right? And not all, I say that with a grain of salt, but you've got to get rid of the stressors. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Can I ask a couple questions real quick?
Yeah.
So what SNPs may contraindicate taking, there's a discussion on here about glutathione, the liposomal, the activated forms, and then what SNPs might contraindicate taking liposomal glutathione. Somebody had taken an injection and then didn't feel well.
Yeah, so sometimes what happens is if you are okay on your glutathione levels and you take extra, you can back it up because the body has this thing called the negative feedback loop. And so it's detecting, oh, there's high enough of that. I don't need to make it. I don't have to waste my time with that. And so if there's a backup and you just provided more of it, all the precursors that are going to be converted into that build up. And there's other pathways, I don't have it in front of me, but there's other pathways that it goes to that will build up the sulfur. You could probably see that best on Ben Lynch's sheet, which I have coming up in the future, but future in the presentation. But yeah, that's a great question. And there, a CBS upregulation can be problematic. Like if you have a CBS and it's upregulated, it's converting too much down into that pathway. And then there's too much going to the glutathione already and you probably don't need it. Certainly with the GSTs and GSMs and all that, the glutathione transferases and all, usually you need glutathione, but that's where I'm a fan of test. Don't guess, right? So test with them. I don't mean test by getting a lab test. You can go to the organic acid test is a good one. And even on the Dutch test, they have a marker for glutathione status. So if the glutathione status is super good, then don't add it, right? So if the glutathione status is off, then it's a good time to add it. But also, if you're not sure, you don't have all those tests done, you don't have the funds to do it, they don't want to do it, well, just let's look at how you react. Start with what I love about liposomal is you give them one drop. You don't have to give them a teaspoon like the thing says. You just give them a drop. Then you give them two drops and you build it up, right? Especially asking questions like, do you have trouble with sulfur-containing amino foods, like high sulfur foods? Have you ever taken MSM and had a problem, which is methyl sulfonic methane? If you have trouble with too many glutathione, cruciferous vegetables or too much onion and garlic, which are high sulfur foods. So you can ask questions rather than what test to do or what SNP to look for. You want to ask a lot of questions. I am such a big fan of questions. I'm such a big fan of actually really getting to the root and asking questions that people go, oh, I have never asked those questions. I've never been asked those questions. Oh, so you're thinking that you had a problem with glutathione. What else is going on? Do they have a SNP in the CBS and is it upregulated? Do they have troubles with the cruciferous or the onions or the garlic or other sulfur-containing foods? And there are a bunch of other SNPs, the salts, the salt SNPs. And if you look at the pathway, which I don't know exactly where it is, but when we get there, I'll stop and I'll go back through it. We'll see the pathway for the sulfur is, it's just very much, it's got the sulfates and the sulfites and all that, and those things build up. And you know how people have problems when they eat dried fruit that's treated with sulfates or sulfites? There are particular genes that cause that, and I think it's in the salt family. Okay? Anything else?
No, perfect. Thank you.
Perfect. Okay, great. Great questions. I'm glad you guys are thinking. It shows me that you're really thinking this through. So the detox, we have, you know, I thought I took those out. But we have nutrients that speed up phase one and nutrients that slow phase two. And speed up phase one and slow down phase one. And why would you ever want to slow down your detox pathways? Because of the I Love Lucy syndrome. Right? If it's coming too fast, the liver can't handle it. If phase one is fast, 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 and phase two is slow, then you have this buildup and the liver wants to store it, and they usually will store that stuff as fat. So there's the SNPs for phase one. And these have a lot of different mechanisms for each one, right? So the 1A1 detoxifies the polycyclic hydrocarbons, and you don't want somebody to be pumping their own gas if they have this, right? It's not a good idea to pump your gas because you're smelling it. To be standing around when somebody's, you know, you stop and talk to somebody and the car's still running, that's not good for people with this SNP. So really looking at each of these SNPs and what it helps to do and how you can enhance it. So if you look at 1B1, it helps detoxify estrogen and upregulates 4-hydroxyestrogen. So this is something that we want to look at. Somebody has a history of uterine cancer or breast cancer or fibroids, etc. And then if you look at, like, say, 1A2, it detoxifies caffeine and estrogen and Tylenol and aflatoxin. So if you have somebody eating peanuts, taking Tylenol, and drinking coffee, and they have this SNP, they're at much higher risk of breast cancer because you're slowing down the liver's ability to handle the estrogen because you're burdening it with your Tylenol, your peanuts, which contain aflatoxin, and your coffee. So these are kinds of things you can take into consideration in coaching people through this. Well, yeah, you can keep drinking caffeine and taking Tylenol whenever you get a headache and eating peanuts, but here's the downside. And if you want to take the risk, we always have to present the risk rewards to people. I'm not taking a chance of having breast cancer just because I want to eat peanuts and drink coffee. It doesn't make sense to me, right? So we want to get to the root cause. And there's just a whole list of nutrients. You have this in your slides. So I would print some of these, like go through your slides. They're all up on the site. And the ones that really contain reference materials, create yourself a little book. You can get, I don't know if I have one here, but there's these really cool things you can get at the store. Well, you can punch them like this. You can go to Kinko's and put this little binder thing on them, or there's another better way, because I like this other way better, and I don't have it here, but I have this particular kind of a notebook. Let's see. No, it's probably in the other bookshelf. And you can get it at Office Max or whatever. And they have this little, it's like a loose leaf binder, but it's soft and it's small. And it's really easy to open and then bind it through. Of course, you can get just a regular binder, but I really like that because it's flexible and it doesn't take up a lot of space to do that. And you just have them on your desk, like the nutrients for detox. What are some of the reference materials that you want from this weekend that we did together? And then what do you do, right? You got to decrease the toxic load. People want to, I'm going to go to liver cleanse and drink all these powders and potions and take all these nutrients, but they're still living in a toxic environment and overloading the poor liver, right? Avoid the foods that interfere with detoxification. And we had some of those charts in there. Recommend foods and herbs that enhance it, reduce stress, improve digestion. And in our NEPT program, we do have a whole module on detoxification. And that module has all of this, like everything you need. It's like hours of videos and reference charts and everything you need, and even handouts that you can give your clients. So if you haven't gone through that module yet, be sure to go through it. And if you haven't joined NEPT yet, talk to Lynn, because we would love to have you on board, because the journey is going to be phenomenal. And the phase two detoxification SNPs, they're in five stages. There's actually a sixth one, but glutathione, acetylation, glucuronidation, sulfation, and methylation. We only did a couple of these because, again, we ran out of time. My goal is to get all of them finished. But if you do that genetic detoxification report, it has all of these sections in it, right? And the responses are going to be really similar, that like what you're going to do is going to be really similar to the ones that we did give you, which was the glutathione and acetylation, I believe. It's avoid the stuff, add some nutrients, support the liver, take away the burden on it is what I want to say. And also, you know, the sweating, saunas, movement, things to get your lymph moving to help them. So this is the glutathione ones and, you know, the GSR, the GSS, the GSGM 1 and 3, and they do slightly different things, but you see the response that we're going to take is very similar, very, very similar. So where is it? If somebody tells you, and this is where I want to get to you guys to get to, and we do a lot of this in our module on history taking, is what are the questions you're going to ask based on their SNPs, and what SNPs are you going to look at based on what they tell you, right? So you really want to look at, do they have specific symptoms that might predispose to this? And if they have this SNP, what are some of the things you can recommend that they do? It's all a matter of taking it all into account, right? So what do you do for methylation SNPs? You know, being careful with the methylation supplementation to avoid problems with COMT if they have that. And this, I want to go through this quickly, but just to kind of show you. So autoimmune, what do they have? You know, if they come in with Sjogren's or lupus or Hashimoto's, look to see if they have the genes associated with it. And usually they do, because usually with autoimmune diseases, there's a genetic piece, there's a leaky gut, and there's stress. Those are the three things that are needed to make an autoimmune. And the stress can be anything from food stress, toxic exposure stress, heavy metal stress, emotional and mental stress. The leaky gut has to be healed and the genetic tendency is there. So somebody could have all those stressors and the leaky gut and not get an autoimmune disease because they're missing that one piece, which is the genetic tendency. So it's look at them and say, even if they don't have a disease at this point, it's a really good thing to look at and say, look, you have all this tendency and we need to be really pristine because you're heading in the direction of an autoimmune disease. And we want to catch it before it becomes an autoimmune disease and damages tissue in your body rather than waiting until it expresses. And there is a test that's listed over there, the Cyrex Array 5, that you can do to test for a variety of autoantibodies, up to, I think there's like 35 of them that are tested in there. You can do individual ones, but I often find to help people who just want to be the best help they can and have family history of autoimmune and don't want to go down that path, that they run that panel. It's an expensive panel, $600. But if you already had Hashimoto's antibodies tested, you know you have an autoimmune disease, I don't think you need that panel. I just don't think you need it. You might want to go back and run it again to see if the antibodies are gone. But you don't need to run the panel because it's going to show you the antibodies. If you already have it, you already had told you had Hashimoto's. But if you don't have Hashimoto's antibodies and you're not well, there might be antibodies somewhere else in the system. I've seen intrinsic factor antibodies. What does that do? Well, somebody is like taking so much B12 and not getting it absorbed. Intrinsic factor absorbs it. It helps the body to absorb B12 down in the distal ileum. So there's things like that. It's like really look at this and say, what do I need to do for me? What do I need to do for them? With, you got to keep in mind their pocketbooks too. What are the tests that you really need to run versus what are the tests that you already know what the results are going to be versus how do you use the test to motivate people to actually make change? Because sometimes that's what it takes, is seeing it in black and white, not just hearing your opinion. Make sense? So yeah, if they have any of the antibodies, you got to just do general autoimmune. And we have on the autoimmune page in NEPT, we do have a protocol that I laid out for these are the steps to take with any autoimmune disease. And of course, you're going to, you know, take the steps to help them. Then there's the digestion, which we never got to make those SNP charts for, but I have three pages of this. So by the time we got to this, it was like, okay, I don't have time for this. And I don't know which of these are actually showing on the reports that we get, So I wanted to make it real practical for you at Shine. I gave you these charts and you can certainly look them up. I know some of these are there, and FUT2 we talked a lot about there, which is somebody has that. You've got to make sure their bifida status is good. You've got to. And bifidobacter will also help with making or feeding the oxalobacter, which is important for breaking down oxalates. So people just go, okay, I'm just going to go on a low oxalate diet for the rest of my life. Well, that's challenging because the oxalates are in everything healthy and everything yummy, right? But what if they don't have to? What if you just have to go off the oxalates for a while you're healing the leaky gut, and then you slowly introduce them back and they don't have to do it? And if they don't have some of these genes, then you know that you can more safely do it. But the FUT2 is an important one for oxalate sensitivity as well as a whole lot of other stuff because it affects the level of bifidus. If somebody has the FUT2, I just err on the side of caution and get them to do probiotic-containing foods and add some extra bifidus to it. And Custom Probiotics and Claire Labs both have a bifidus-only supplement. 3 pages of this stuff. And you can see there's some overlap, like the GAD, because GABA is important in the gut. And this is a conversion of glutamate to GABA. It's important in the gut, too, the MAO, right? Some of the brain stuff is also implicated in the gut. So you've got that. Sweet tooth. Who has a sweet tooth? No? SLC2A2. Go look it up. See if you have an SLC2A2 for sweet tooth. The bitter tasting gene. Now, some of the people who say, wow, that smoothie or that juice was so good. And others say, oh my God, that smoothie recipe you gave me was so bad. Bitter tasting gene. They really taste the bitter. And my husband has the bitter tasting gene and he don't like things as bitter as I do. But he also has the sweet taster gene, which I don't. And so he wants things sweeter. And when I'm working with somebody, I work with somebody who I'd like, she had to put stevia in every smoothie when we were trying to go low glycemic and she couldn't have fruit. She had to put stevia in every smoothie. I'm like, but just put savory in, just put some garlic, just put some oregano and it tastes really good. And you're like, just give me some stevia. Like, just give me some stevia. So if that's the case, look these up so you can give yourself a break and you can give this person a break. Look, the reason that you don't like the bitters as much as this. Let's see what we can do to enhance the taste, like putting kale in brownies. What better way is that? Make them super sweet if they have the sweet tasting, more stevia, more Lohan, more whatever, low glycemic sweetener. And wow, you have this amazing way, amazing package to get them to eat some of this stuff. Okay. And what do you do? Really, you got to reduce stress at mealtimes. So many people want the fancy probiotic and the enzymes and the herbs and all this stuff, when in reality, if they just sit and breathe a few times and be grateful before they eat, it's going to go a long way to enhancing digestion. And there's so many people who go, I don't know why I have such crappy digestion, and they're eating or they're watching TV and the news and hearing all this horrific stuff. You got to do this in the right way. Digestive hygiene, slow down, chew your food well. Just be cognizant and be conscious of the food that you're eating. Appreciate it. And I said this over and over again at Shine. I'm going to say it again. You only taste the food when it's in your mouth. So why are we in such a bloody rush to get it out of our mouth? We only taste it there. We only chew it there. We only break it down there. And the beauty of chewing more is that you get to taste it longer. So why not keep it in your mouth longer? Even when I'm drinking a juice or a smoothie, I'll put it in on my mouth. And swallow. Because I want it to linger. I want it to stimulate some of the amylase receptors and some of the digestive stuff. It triggers the stomach acid, it triggers the lubrication of the digestive tract. So keep it in the mouth longer. Blood sugar, my favorite subject, actually. You guys have been in Sweet Spot. You know how passionate I am about it because it's so overlooked. You know, so many people talking about digestion. There's not a lot of people talking about blood sugar except for talking diabetes. But we're not talking diabetes here. We're talking, let's get you in balance before you get diabetes. Because once you get it, there's already so much damage done. There's peripheral nerve damage. There's retinal damage. There's kidney damage. I don't want to wait till the doctor says you have diabetes. I want to circumvent it and detect the tendency early. And those of you who've been in sweet spot who've had really good results with that, you didn't know you had a blood sugar problem until you went through this and went, oh my God, I had no idea. Right? It makes all the difference in the world, and we do really need to do it. I keep wondering if I should flip my pyramid base between digestion and blood sugar, but there's pros and cons of both. They both need to be balanced. Before you start doing any fancy protocols for anything else, you got to get the blood sugar and the digestion balanced, because nothing else can function without that. Nothing else can function. So that's why we have two separate programs, the insulin resistance and the digestive mastery for practitioners, because these are the two you've got to master. And those of you who want to really master everything else, then you come into NEPT. But if you've not been in our blood sugar balancing, or you've not been in our CMDS, you know, talk to Lynn. She'll get you hooked up, because whichever one you're missing, do. And if you really want to go all the way, you know, the NEPT, where we go into all the functional lab testing and all the different organ and gland systems and the history and the labs, the blood tests, and so much more. And all of our case study calls, where you get to learn tremendous amounts. But yeah, so these are some of the blood sugars. I think I have 3/4 of these genes. When I went, I spent an evening looking all these up. Actually, I spent 4 hours, because it took a long time, looking up all the blood sugar related genes and then writing a little description and then looking up which ones do I have. And I believe I had, I want to say 3/4 of them. So it's a big tendency that I have towards this. And when you know that about a person, you know what the deal is. And when you know they have a lot of the SNPs for, you know, anxiety and hyper-irritability, and they snap at you, or they get frustrated and they're always like wacky, that you need to be working and helping them with coping mechanisms, as well as, of course, the balancing mechanisms. And you can be a little bit more patient with them when you know it's in their genes, that it's not really about them being mad at you. So sugar-related, decrease sugar load, support methylation, avoid foods that interfere with insulin receptor sensitivity. We know some of those, right? The processed foods, the chemicals, the hydrogenated oils and all that, foods that enhance it. We have a free report that we did last year. We'll probably announce it again soon. But we have a little really nice graphic that our graphics person made that just is like a few pages long of all the foods that help insulin absorption and all the foods that don't. So if you want to get a copy of that, we can probably find the link somewhere to get that. I think it might be insulinresistancefoods.com or something like that. And learn how to do glucose testing. So like I said, if you haven't taken insulin resistance, do take it. If you have, review this. Teach people how to test their glucose. This is critical for follow-up. So critical. Daily exercise routine. So the exercises, we find the burst training, but some people don't want to do it, can't do it. They have specific limitations. Find exercise and movement that they can do to increase the oxygenation and decrease the sugar. It was an interesting article I just copied it into my read later folder today that came in and said, why exercise sometimes increases blood sugar. And I've been theorizing about that and talking to people. I want to see what this article says. Managing stress, proper meal timing, don't eat right before bed. Don't follow the dogma that's out there that's really dumb and not based on science of eat every 2 hours to maintain blood sugar. It's a Band-Aid, guys. It's a Band-Aid. So yeah, you get cranky and irritable if you don't eat, or you get hyper if you don't eat, then just put a Band-Aid on it and eat more frequently. Sure, it might work in the short term, but we really need to fix the problem. And that's what I want you guys out there doing. That's when we change the paradigm, is when we don't put Band-Aids on, we get to the root cause. There's mitochondrial disorders. Some people who have low energy, it may be in the mitochondria. It's important to address B vitamin status. It's important to address stomach acid, because amino acids are so important here. So, you know, if you have any of these low, you know, just make sure that you've got your things. Look at the Krebs cycle chart. We have a whole module called Energy Metabolism, Module 2 of NEPT. So those of you who joined, or those of you who joined the core program, we have it in there too. But we have in your bag that you got at Shine, there's a little disc. You know, what do they call those? A jump drive? Yeah, a jump drive. And it's got modules 1, 2, and 3, plus all the assessments in there. And if you signed up on the live stream and didn't get that, Scott's sending it to you. He's putting it in the mail and sending you all the goodies that were in there, including Mushroom Mama, which is one of my favorite things. So you decrease the toxic load because toxins affect the mitochondria. The mitochondria produce their own oxidative byproducts. And if there's a lot of byproducts, you're going to have a backup. Avoid the foods like the sugars, the processed grains, oxidized fats. Here's what it is. When you eat sugar, you are getting sugar and no B vitamins. And you need B vitamins to take it through the mitochondria. So it doesn't go there. And it goes through a different pathway that only produces 2 ATPs. Instead of 36, and then the food doesn't get into the cells because of the insulin resistance, and what happens? You eat and you get fat instead of eating and having energy. So we don't want that for our clients. So the greens, the rainbow vegetables, the fruits, omega-3s, things that are high in antioxidant status, reducing stress, intermittent fasting. Intermittent fasting can be wonderful, and it sounds like scary to people. But then when they try it, they go, wow, this is actually pretty good. And it's been shown to do things like decrease insulin levels and increase growth hormone levels, which is the things we want to do for most people, right? I am right now on my 4th day of a 5-day fast. So tomorrow's my last. I may go longer, but I decided that I like to do that. I like to do longer fasts like 3 or 4 times a year. And then I do the intermittent fasting. There's 2 ways to do it. The one way of intermittent fasting is to just have a window that you eat. So it's a reduced window. Like during this 8-hour period, I eat and I fast 16 hours a day. The other way is to do a 24-hour fast where you eat lunch and you don't eat again until lunch the next day, or you eat dinner and you don't eat again until dinner the next day, or you eat breakfast and you don't eat again until breakfast the next day. And I ask people to just find out what works for them. And I've had people go, wow, this is so great. If I have breakfast, then I can skip until breakfast the next day and I feel great. For me, if I had breakfast, all bets are off. I just want to eat the rest of the day. So I skip breakfast. That's just the way it goes for me. It's always been that way. There's the estrogen metabolism, the main ones, you know, I put on here, the COMT, and the CYP 1B1 and the 1B2. And you can see they go down different pathways, right? And so it's important that if somebody has these disruptions, that we're careful about the estrogen containing foods. And I have another chart, which we have in, I don't remember what module, I think it's module 1 of NEPT, that has the foods and the environmentals that affect the estrogen metabolism. But we want to avoid these 4s. We definitely want to avoid these 4s. And you just see all the different snips there in the boxes. SAM and SAMe and magnesium are super important. This, and this was taken from one of the Ben Lynch things. What do? You increase cruciferous vegetables. Some people take DIM or I3C. I prefer increasing cruciferous vegetables, and there's ways to do it. I don't like taking extracts out of things unless it's absolutely necessary, but you can actually get broccoli sprout powder. It's hard to get broccoli sprouts all year, and it's also hard to eat the amounts that you need to restore these pathways. So broccoli sprout powder, 1 tablespoon or 2 in your smoothies. Foods, you got to get the gut going. You've got to do the foundational diet and lifestyle habits. And the supplements would be B vitamins, especially B6 when it comes to estrogen metabolism, selenium, magnesium, DIM. So those are possibilities for you if people are out of balance. But you don't start with the bottom. You start with the top. Histamine-related genes. So if somebody says, I eat and I get stuffy and I don't know why, it doesn't matter what I eat, look to see if they have any of these histamine-related genes. Fat metabolism-related genes, ApoE, 3-4 or 4-4. You got to be careful with the fat. ApoA2, C or a T SNPs, regulates the after-meal response to saturated fat. How's the body handling that saturated fat? Is it clumping in the vessels, or is it being, you know, converted to energy? PPAR-G, also related to diabetes, and ADIPOQ is an adipose-specific gene. So if somebody has issues, I would like to see, Lynn, what yours are in this particular area, because I know you say you have difficulty if you eat too much fat. So it'd be good to know, oh, yeah, you have trouble with fat. You've got some genetics. So let's, decrease the amount. Take some lipase with it. You know, do things to stimulate bile acids by having some bitters with the meal, and that could help. So it helps you to see, oh, they have these SNPs. What can I do so that they don't express these SNPs and have the negative downsides? We're almost there, guys. So using genetics to personalize health plans. So we've got to focus on all of these foundations. More water, regular hours and enough sleep, meditation, regular exercise, maintaining normal weight, healthy diet, more fruits and veggies, and drink more water twice. Walk more, and walk more is at the top. So we got to get things going, right? And these are the basic lifestyle pieces that we can get people on, regardless of their SNPs, that's going to help. But when you're personalizing it, you may know, like, this person with all the GADs and MAOs and COMTs really needs a meditation practice, a regular daily practice to do it. This person who has, you know, difficulties with certain pathways, that they, you know, they don't metabolize properly. You've got to figure it out. Water is super important for everybody. So it's helping us to personalize all these aspects for the person. So the factors that influence, I'm going to reiterate this. I've said this over and over, is foundation, 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 clean food, clean